February 20th, 2020. That is today. We are coming to you. That is tonight. It's almost February 21st, which so I'm Matt Minnick, and I'm joined here by Michael Rogner on the Tomahawk Nation Hoops Dedicated podcast. And so we are now getting into, Michael, less than 10 days from March. And I know that March Madness doesn't really start on March 1st, but you can start to smell the madness in the air. Are you getting ready for it? Have you taken off the whole week of work that coming up here in about a month?
Are you telling me that March Madness has not started? It's started in my house. So
yeah. What do you have any traditions, by the way?
Besides taking the days off, the first 2 days of the NCAA tournament, the first two real days are the best 2 days in sports. Better than Sunday at the Masters, better than the Super Bowl or whatever. The first 2 days of the NCAA tournament. So I always take those days off of work and spend the day on my couch or on a stool in a bar.
Yeah, so totally with you on better than the Super Bowl, and I even sometimes have a rooting interest there with the Packers. But Sunday at the Masters, that's going bold. You tell me that Tiger and maybe Koepka and Mickelson are all in contention there Sunday at the Masters. But I agree with you. The first 2 days of March Madness are pretty special. This year, I actually have a meeting that I have got to – can't get out of, but it takes place in the morning. And since I'm in Eastern time zone, I have the afternoon off and the Friday. So should be good to go. So we're going to talk some March as during this podcast, as it is coming up in 9 days from now. But we're going to talk more in terms of the rooting interest, like giving you a rooting guide for this weekend as we think about the seeds that everyone is gunning for in March. But we're going to talk about we're going to recap the Pitt game, which went about as expected, and of course we're going to preview the NC State game, an NC State team that is coming off a total demolition of the Duke Blue Devils. Let's start with Pitt, though, Michael. We talked, both of us, I think, predicted a solid victory, and that seemed to be the case. What did you see there? I mean, did anything surprise you?
I thought the one thing that jumped out is that this is a game that could have gotten away from Pitt really early. They are a team that's a little bit challenged in terms of height and sometimes in terms of shooting. They had three key players, Justin Champagny, Xavier Johnson, and Audrey Toney, all pick up two fouls in the first half. And if you remember back to, our visit to Pitt, we had key players, MJ Walker and Devin Vassell, pick up two fouls. They sat for the last 18 and a half minutes of the first half, finished the game with three fouls. Pitt's coach, Jeff Capel, managed things a little bit differently. He played Audrey Toney for the last 9 minutes of the second half with two fouls. He played Champagny 6 minutes with two fouls, and Champagny had some moments in that game where that kid is going to be a load in the future. And then Xavier Johnson played 5 minutes in the first half with two fouls. So had he had a policy of auto-sitting two guys, like a coach that he was coaching against that night has, that game would have been totally, just a blowout by halftime. But he hung with his guys. They probably committed some fouls, but the refs were not going to call them. If once players have two fouls in the first half, you really have to do something wrong, to pick up that third foul. And so all three guys got through the first half with only two fouls. So I thought it was a good job of Capel kind of keeping his team in it, but then, the second half happened and Patrick Williams was unguardable and we pretty much rolled him.
Pretty much rolled them indeed. The lead got as big as 22 and quite honestly probably could have been closer to 30 if Florida State didn't once again lose the free throw battle against Pitt. I think I saw you tweet at some point that what is that, like 100 and something attempts for Pitt from the free throw line in the last three games against Florida State. Part of that, as we discussed in the pregame, is that Pitt gets to the line frequently, right? I mean, that's kind of what they do. And we are are very good at sending teams to the line. That is, we've picked up that hallmark this year. And on the flip side of that, we're also very good at turning teams over and blocking shots. So there is some risk reward there. But yeah, this was a game that honestly, for the last, let's say 17 minutes, just was never, the outcome was never in doubt. And as you said, Patrick Williams again showed that he is the best athlete on the court most times when he takes the court. And now you're looking at an athlete, 6'8", 220-pound athlete who is starting to put some of the other things together too and starting to have the game slow down for him. This was his second KenPom MVP designation in a row. It's his third in the last five games. So he certainly has taken a next step. And in 22 minutes played, the youngster had 16 points, four offensive rebounds, and a block. He also made a three. So he's made at least one three in four out of the last five games as well. So truly starting to display a well-rounded game. Let me ask you one question. We went to a zone in the first half. And as if you've watched Florida State basketball play for a while, you know that that is a rare thing under Leonard Hamilton. Did you like the move to the zone? And second, what did you think of FSU's execution of the zone?
I love the move to the zone. You know, typically, you know, Ham will often pull out the zone for like one possession at the end of a half just to confuse a coach. But he got tired of seeing Pitt just drive into the lane sort of uncontested and went to a zone that was just, from a X's and O's perspective, was just kind of fun to watch. I mean, those guys were flying around, covering some ground. I saw some comments that maybe he went zone to try to rest Forrest, but that's not a zone you run to rest anybody. I mean, that's a super active zone, if you want to call it like a diamond and one or a 1-3-1 or whatever the case. When we rolled out the zone, Pitt was confused. They didn't know what to do. They had a stretch of like six or seven possessions where they maybe scored one time, so it was effective. And then there was a timeout or a media break of some sort, and after that they pretty much got whatever they wanted against the zone. You know, once he was able to remind his players, you know, how to attack that kind of zone, They did a pretty good job, and we saw, Ham go. We saw Ham go man to man for most of the rest of the way.
Yeah, So I'm totally with you on liking the move to it. I think that if nothing else, man, it put something great on film that maybe another coach has to think about. And you know what? I think that I don't want us to move away from our man-to-man staple, and I don't even mind us switching on a lot of stuff. I know that sometimes we can get into trouble with the switching, but I think over the long haul, it does more good than bad, particularly when I say long haul, when you really zoom out and you think about what we talked about last time, that guys like Polite, Gray, Osborne, all these guys are going to be on the team for another 2 years. And so you really want to, you know, when we talked about the 2012 team before and how that team could essentially switch, it was a team full of grown men that were all third and fourth year players, and it could essentially switch into almost any defense it needed to at any time because they all were just that comfortable in our systems. And so you have to know that Leonard Hamilton, as he always is playing the long game. And so he's trying to get guys comfortable in something that is going to pay dividends, not just this season, but down the road. So I don't want us to go away from that. That said, I think that we have some athletes like Devin Vassell and Patrick Williams, Trent Forrest, who their length and their lateral quickness can probably be an effective zone at times, right? In 5-6 possession stretches, especially if we rep it a little more. So I really liked it. Before we move too far away or go on from the Pitt game, which I don't think we're going to spend much more time on it, but Trent Forrest had a kind of good news, bad news, right? Like good news, he only played 25 minutes, and we had talked about like, gosh, this has to be a game that we get his minutes under 30. Mission accomplished. Went 2-for-4 from three. How about that? Only the second time this season and I believe career that he's made multiple threes in a game. So really starting to see, I mean, so he was 2 for 4 in this game. He was 1 for 1 in the Syracuse game. He also made one in the UNC game. So he truly is becoming someone who is at least comfortable shooting the three. I don't know if I'd quite use the word threat for him. But, you know, under 100 offensive rating, he had 4 turnovers. That goes along with his 6 turnovers against Syracuse. Some of them just seem awfully careless. We talked earlier in the year about, is he just making maybe mistakes because his efficiency has been, or his usage has been forced to go up so much? Or is it some, is he starting to fall into a little bit of a trap of like, he focuses in more for the bigger opponents and almost picks his spots of when senior Trent Forrest has to really dial in and be senior Trent Forrest and kind of gets a little lackadaisical, does it look like in other moments?
Yeah, I think I'd actually add another theory there in that he's just tired. You know, he played the entire second half against Syracuse and turned the ball over 6 times, turned it over 4 against Pitt. And some of those turnovers are plays that he typically would not try to make, you know, some of the passes. And so I'm hoping that his, you know, as your legs get tired, you know, it affects you mentally. It affects your ability to, you know, to process what's happening. And so I think a few of those turnovers were probably just him being tired. But in general, you know, the larger perspective on Trent and the rest of the starters is that all of the starters, you know, 3 of them didn't even score in the first half. Devin Vassell's first shot didn't come until the, you know, like 13 minutes into the game.
Devin was awful. And I like Devin a lot, both as a player and a guy. But he was terrible in this game.
Yeah, the starters as a whole were underwhelming, especially in the first half. I thought that Forrest, even though he, you know, was not particularly efficient and turned the ball over 4 times, was probably the best of those guys. And MJ Walker, you know, also had some really, really nice drives in that game, you know, despite the, you know, he started with that face mask and you know, got rid of that. But then he got hit in the face a couple times. He took that flagrant foul. So he was toughing it out and making some good things happen. And then before we move on, I do want to mention Balsa and Dom. You know, there's 2 games in a row that they've been pretty good. If you combine their stats, it was like 29 minutes, 15 points, 9 boards. Balsa had 3 assists, which you don't often see from your big man. And 2 of them were good.
Yeah,
dimes. There was that one, that little pocket pass in the second half where no look in traffic. A little slip pass to the guy cutting to the basket. And then the other one that stood out was when he caught the rebound and Raekwon was cutting to the basket. And he caught the rebound and threw it to him all in one motion. It was just, you know, really pretty basketball. So he is starting to come on. You know, we talk a lot about Patrick Williams, kind of the lights coming on for Patrick Williams. And I think the same thing could be said for Balsa. He's not going to impact the games nearly as much as Patrick Williams. But – you know, Balsa is a guy who's probably going to be here 3 years, and you know, you can really see that the college game has slowed down enough that he's able to be a little bit more effective. You know, this was a guy who was not dominant at all in high school, you know, so we can't expect him to be dominant at this level right away. But you know, he's stringing together some good games, which is good to see.
I'm glad you brought them up. You know, everything that you said, I think, is spot on. They looked like they were a bit more aggressive too, but in a controlled way. And Dom seems to pick up offensive fouls left and right. But both of them, I felt like really attacked the glass, attacked the rim. God, was it Dom that had a dunk there? Maybe in the first half, I actually was surprised there wasn't a tech. He sort of did like a.
The rim rattle.
Yeah, well, he kind of like did like a half pull up almost on the rim, and I'm pleasantly surprised there wasn't a tech. These are kids; they should have fun. But no, I was pleased that versus maybe the Duke game or something where they just didn't seem to really attack anything with any aggression, that they seem to bring a little bit more about that. And while we're on Dom, you know, way back in like podcast maybe number 3 or 4, we talked about how, you know, everyone has roles to play. And like you said, nobody, they might not have a huge impact on any one game, but you've got to get these role players are what allow a deep March run. And we, one of the roles that they have to play is rebounding. And we talked about how Dom, for whatever his, you know, areas of weakness are, or things that he's just never going to be, you know, like a shot blocker, for example, his offensive rebounding numbers have kind of maintained through the year. We said, well, we need to go back and look at that 3, 4, 5 weeks from now. You know, here's a guy who 9.3% of the offensive available offensive boards when he was on the court at Drake his freshman year, 8.7 at Ole Miss his sophomore year, 7.8 at Ole Miss his junior year. And again, we're talking about, of all the shots that his team takes while he's on the court, he rebounded 7.8% of them, right? Like, he grabbed almost 8% of the available offensive rebounds when he was on the court. This year at Florida State, 14.1. So the only time in his career he's in double digits, and he's well, well above his previous rate. And then you look over at Bolsa, who's just a freshman, and he's grabbing defensive rebounds at 15.5% of the time that he's on the court. So those two guys are really giving Florida State something in their limited time when they're on the floor. And hey, it's important to have role players fill their role. So let's move on from that and maybe get into a little bit of discussion just on the ACC in general. We had talked about several of the games that were going on that were kind of big around for the standings. And even on this pod a couple weeks ago, we said, well, hey, you know what? That Florida State loss to Duke probably ends any chance at finishing as a one seed in the ACC. I will say I'll be happy to eat crow if this happens, but it does seem like that door has been pushed open thanks to Duke getting just destroyed by NC State. Can you talk a little bit about that game, how it happened, and then also maybe some of the ramifications there?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, maybe that was the first time they've seen NC State play this year, and they go out and beat Duke by 22. They make 62% of their threes, and they didn't take a bunch, but they made them. And just to calm fans down a little bit, NC State is not a good shooting team. You know, that was a fluke. That was one of those things where we're always talking about, how does this happen to Florida State that, you know, Scott Wood, this freshman, comes in and makes seven, whatever. You know, that was kind of their game. Markel Johnson made five threes against Duke. But even beyond the shooting, you know, they just tore Duke apart. The only real effective offense that Duke had was Vernon Carey. And when they were making their comeback in the second half, I think they cut the score from about 22 points down to 11. And that was all playing through Vernon Carey. And then for whatever reason, they went like four straight possessions where he didn't even touch the ball, and the lead was, you know, ballooned back up. And so I don't know what was going on with the Duke coaching staff, and they clearly had a weapon that NC State could not stop, and they just went away from using him. He ended up with 27 points, 12 boards, and that was with, you know, Trey Jones and you know, Wendell Moore trying to play hero for most of the second half. So it's a fun game. It's all, you know, I was getting texts from buddies, you know, all over the country, because these are the games that national people tune into. And so, and it's always fun to watch Duke lose. So, you know, go State, I guess.
It was a fun game. And so State's kind of made a habit of this, frankly. I think, what is this? This is like, it's either three of the last four times that Duke's coming to Raleigh, or four of the last five, but State seems to take the NC State Duke rivalry more seriously, I think, perhaps than Duke does, which conversely, I think Roy Williams takes the UNC-NC State rivalry very seriously, and UNC has dominated NC State over the last decade. But State has had a lot of success against Duke, particularly in Raleigh. That success has not always translated into success against a lot of other teams. State's basketball team, very much like their football team, in that they are able to get up for, you know, in football, the Florida States and the Clemsons of the world when they come to Carter-Finley, and NC State is able to get up for Dukes and you know, this year of Florida State when they come to the PNC Center. But that win did have some pretty big ramifications. So here's what we're looking at. First of all, there's a whole bunch of trash down at the bottom of the league, Pitt, Miami, Wake, North Carolina. all of them already have double-digit conference losses. And I know that we're playing in a 20-game schedule now, so you know the win totals are going to be inflated just like the loss totals are, but all of them already have double-digit conference losses. There's a whole bunch of mediocrity there in the middle that have between 7 and 9 losses, and frankly, any team from it wouldn't shock me to finish 5 through probably about 9 with those teams, or 10. And then you've got 4 and really 3 who have kind of separated themselves. So you've got Virginia sitting there at 10-5 in the conference play. Florida State is 12-3. Duke is 12-3. And Louisville's a half game up at 13-3. So here's what you have. We know this, that Florida State and Louisville play each other. So one of those teams is going to lose a game, thus giving them a fourth conference loss. If all three teams finish with 4 losses, so that would mean that Duke has to lose one more time, and then the winner of the Louisville-Florida State game loses somewhere else, and the loser of the Florida State-Louisville game doesn't lose at all. So again, each team of those three has 3 losses right now. If they all finish with 4, then it's a 3-way tie. And the 3-way tie is broken by the cumulative, the record against the other teams in the tie, right? So the winner of the Florida State-Louisville game on Monday will have the best record between a tie of Louisville, Duke, and Florida State. Whoever wins that game between the Cardinals and Seminoles will be guaranteed the best record between those three teams. So that means that if Florida State wins against Louisville on Monday and they're, all three of those teams finish with 4 losses, Florida State would be the 1 seed in the ACC tournament. First of all, did that all make sense? We need to repeat anything. But did I say that correctly, Michael? But also, have you ever dreamed in your wildest imagination of finishing, as the 1 seed in the ACC tournament?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that regardless of what us or Louisville do, Duke has to lose a game somewhere.
Duke has to lose a game in order for any of this to matter. Duke has to lose, and that best chance probably comes at Virginia. What is that, next week?
Yeah, so Duke has to drop a game. We have to play really well, I guess, is the crib notes version of that. And I have thought about Florida State teams winning the ACC regular season, or however you want to call it, being the 1 seed in the ACC tournament.
Yeah, that's like, you don't win anything, but yeah, you win the 1 seed is what you win.
Yeah, I think the ACC changed the laws or something a few years ago that they officially made it okay to hang banners, even though everybody was already hanging banners. So they recognize that you had the best record. They just don't recognize you as the winner or some weird little headache like that. But when I've thought about Florida State teams that might win the ACC, this team was not on that list. You know, I was thinking that this team at the beginning of the season was, you know, probably about an 8 seed in the ACC tournament or in the NCAA tournament. And so the fact that we're talking about how the math could work in our favor to win the ACC is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, we talked a couple of years ago. I say talked. I think we wrote about and talked to ourselves, to each other, about was that the coaching job that Hamilton did with the year that there was just so many injuries and I think Ike had to start like 9 games. It was that kind of his best coaching job ever. They think it still made the Elite Eight. And maybe it was to that point. But I don't want to start the season still is a month to go. I think there's still bigger dreams out there. But man, Coach Hamilton has to be getting some respect for the coaching job he's done this year, both at like a regional level, but a national level. I mean, we're talking about a team that lost six players, including 2 NBA players off of a rock. You know, everyone kind of thought, well, this is going to be a step back year, and will they even make the tournament? I think you and I were a little more bullish on the team than most. And wow, they are just exceeding perhaps the only expectations they're not exceeding are their own. So it certainly is fun to chase. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will talk about some rooting guides for ACC and otherwise for this weekend. And then we'll also break down the matchup against a suddenly hot NC State team. And we are back. All right. So, as promised, we are going to do a little bit of a rooting guide discussion. If you're not familiar with this, this is essentially so in basketball, you know, you're never just playing in a vacuum here. And I think the football fans have sort of started to experience more of this now that there's a playoff in football as well. But, you know, your seeding that you're trying to go for, whether it's in the ACC or March, of course, is being impacted by all the other teams that are around you as well. And so when we look at the let's get one out the door real quickly. If you want that FSU one seed thing to happen, right, any Duke loss is a good loss, because we need them to whether FSU wins out or not, we need them to pick up some, at least one more loss. And Louisville is interesting. If you want that three-way tie with each team having four losses, probably need Louisville to win their games when they're not playing Florida State. If you think that Duke could lose two games and Florida State could win out, if you think Florida State could win out, then it probably doesn't matter what Louisville does. But I don't know that I'm convinced that Florida State will win out. So in the ACC, I'd say root for Duke to lose. Probably doesn't much matter after that. Let's go to the bracket matrix, though, and look at the teams that are around Florida State. Where is Florida State on the bracket matrix, Michael? And who are we competing with for a high seed?
So in today's update, which should include games through probably Tuesday night or something, Florida State would be the last of the two seeds, so the eighth overall seed. The one seeds Baylor, Kansas, San Diego State, Gonzaga. The two seeds are Duke, Dayton, Maryland, Florida State. So we're right in there battling for a two seed. Louisville is immediately behind us. So if we take care of business against them and finish strong, then I like our chances of finishing ahead of them. But there's still a lot of other teams there in the mix that, you know, that are also all playing big games. We might not be watching them. But there's, you know, plenty of basketball games that happen every single day that impact Florida State's seeding in the NCAA tournament. So even tonight, you know, it's Thursday night, not much going on in the basketball world. Oregon is currently down 11 to Arizona State at half. You know, Oregon is on the four seed line. So, you know, we look at those teams that are trying to pass us, and we want them to lose. And so right now, if Florida State is battling for the last two seed, you know, we're worried about everybody pretty much like on the 3-4-5 line. And then obviously the teams ahead of us that we want to lose so that we can pass them.
Right. And so that's a good synopsis right there, right? You want the teams behind us to lose so they don't catch us, and ahead of us to lose so we could catch them, with perhaps some small caveats in there, in that sometimes if, you know, depending on how far behind you go, like if there's like a six seed and Florida State happens to own a win over that six seed, sometimes, you know, you'd want to root for that team, because in this newfangled world of the net, and you've got quad one wins and quad two wins, which if you really want to get in the details, just go to Google and type in, you know, net quadrants basketball, and I'm sure you could find all the reading you want. Tomahawk Nation's written about it in the past as well. But the basic sense of it is that if you beat really good teams or decent teams on the road, really good teams at home or decent teams on the road, you get a quad one win. And those are coveted, as the committee kind of uses those quad wins, the quad one and two wins, to differentiate between teams that might have similar records on the two or three seed line. So let's just get one thing out of the way. Is it realistic that Florida State could catch anyone on that one seed line with Baylor, Kansas, San Diego State, or Gonzaga?
Highly unlikely. I think the one potential would be San Diego State, because they haven't played anybody. So if they were to suddenly lose a game, which it would almost inevitably be a bad loss because they don't play anybody good, they would probably drop. But the likelihood of that happening is not good. Gonzaga, you know, they play St. Mary's and BYU. Outside of that, they have no chance of losing. And then Baylor and Kansas. Baylor especially. Baylor's, their resume is so much better than anybody else's.
Right? Like, yeah, Baylor is a one seed.
Exactly. And Kansas is kind of getting into that territory where, you know, we don't need them to lose once. We need them to lose like three times or four times to think about passing them. And I, you know, that's highly unlikely. So the ones are pretty, you know, set in stone. And when the NCAA released their 16 teams the other day, they even said that afterwards, that the ones are significantly ahead of all the twos, and it's the same ones now as it was, you know, 10 days ago.
Yeah, it's interesting that we hear so much this year about, oh, there's no great teams, there's so much parity, there's no great teams. And I think maybe if you compare this year to previous years, like 2015 or something, there's certainly what happened was, is I think that the recruiting class was a little bit weaker than some past recruiting classes, and that's cyclical. That happens. There's a couple coming up that are actually really strong. And you saw a little bit, maybe a few guys go pro, maybe that were unexpected last year. And so they maybe went a year ahead of their time. Like a Fiondu might qualify for that. Even though he still got picked in the first round, you might have thought, oh, he could last one more year. But as far as like comparing within the contemporaries this year, I don't know if I don't buy that there's no great, like there is definitely separation at the top. I don't know if I buy this parity, at least at the top. Baylor and Kansas, and to some extent Gonzaga in there too, have really kind of separated themselves out. And I'll go a step further and say that the winner of the Baylor-Kansas game on Saturday, they play at noon, should be a great game. I don't know that there's a rooting interest for Florida State. The winner of that game, I will say, is going to be a one seed, maybe even if they lost their remaining four or five games. Their resume would be that good, particularly if it's Baylor getting the sweep over Kansas. They already beat them in Allen Fog. So, yeah, the top feels out of reach. But after that, it does seem like there's some wiggle room. So let's go through maybe a list of games here that are on Saturday and Sunday that you've got your eye on. I know Duke's playing Virginia Tech. We already said that any Duke loss is a good loss. Dayton has Duquesne. Doesn't seem like that's likely. But after that, it seems like there's some real chances at some seed shifting losses here from the teams around us.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of fun games that people should be paying attention to, because it's, you mentioned earlier that it gets complicated sometimes on which teams to root for. But we have Tennessee at Auburn. You know, Florida State beat Tennessee early in the season. Auburn is a Auburn's a team that we want to lose, and so that would be, you know, sort of the double bonus for Florida State, is that if Tennessee can not only pick up a quality win but also knock off a team that we're competing against.
Yeah, Auburn's
and then
four,
the exact same
nine,
thing with
right?
with yeah. Florida. Yeah, Florida, Kentucky. Kentucky is where are they? They're like right around the four or five. They're hosting the Gators, and so, you know, hold your nose and root for the Gators, because we want them to pick up a quality win. We want Kentucky to lose. So that's sort of the gist of it. And then there's some other teams. Villanova, you know, they play at Xavier. Road games are never easy. Villanova's a three seed. And then Penn State, they play on Sunday, right?
Penn State does play on Sunday.
Penn State plays at Indiana.
Yeah, a team we lost to.
Yeah, against a team that – all right, exactly. So we want Indiana to finish strong, so that will be a quad one loss and not a quad two loss.
Absolutely. And Penn State being there on that three line, giving them a loss would be, like you said, double bonus. Maryland is at Ohio State. If any of y'all want to check out CJ Walker, former Florida State guard, click over to CBS at 4 on Sunday. And Maryland is the team that is right ahead of us on the two line on Bracket Matrix. So as we look at, well, are we trying to, you know, maybe move up a spot? Maryland, you know, getting a win at Ohio State would probably solidify them there on that two line. But a loss, while it wouldn't be super damaging at this time of year, any loss, you know, any even dropping one or two spots on the S curve could make a difference. And you've also got West Virginia going to TCU. Is that one where we're rooting for TCU? West Virginia's on the four line. Can they pull off the upset there?
I really like West Virginia, but they've had some head scratchers this year. So, you know, I would not be surprised to see them lose, especially, you know, they have to go and play on the road. I don't remember what time Florida State. I think that's right before the Florida State game. For folks at home, you know, the thing that I like to do on Saturday morning is pull up Bracket Matrix and just see who's around Florida State in the list, and then see who they're playing. And that gives me a good idea for the day on who to root for or root against. The other thing Matt mentioned was, you know, ex-Florida State player C.J. Walker. If you want to tune into Ohio State, you can also tune in to Seton Hall, who plays on Sunday, if you want to see an ex-Florida State player, Ike Obiagu. He will most likely be sitting on the bench, so make sure you look for him as the camera pans by. He played 1 minute. He played 1 minute against Butler the other night.
Has he added weight too? He looks like a totally different guy.
Yeah, it's the real shit side of college basketball. It happens with a lot of these foreign-born players. They come over here, they get some really bad advice, they get some bad people around them, and they led him to a school where he doesn't fit in, where he's not playing, and, you know, happy
for
them.
This is a school that has an assistant coach that's being looked at for transfer tampering violations, correct?
Yeah, so.
That's what I thought. I feel bad for the kid. I actually saw him on campus around the time that he was announcing the transfer, and he almost looked like he had tears in his eyes, saying that he wasn't going to be back with this team that he seemed to love so much. But sounds like Sunday you can catch former Florida State player day between Ohio State and Seton Hall. And really, Saturday should just be a heck of a game. Park yourself in front of your favorite watering hole, and you got the Kansas-Baylor game at noon, that 2 p.m., as you mentioned, the West Virginia-TCU game. Of course, Florida State plays at 4, 6 o'clock. You can hold your nose and root for UF over Kentucky, which would be easier to do after a Florida State win, hopefully. And then Oregon at Arizona at 9, and then, of course, 10 p.m. Gonzaga at BYU. And if you've never seen BYU play at the Marriott Center, that is a treat to watch. So just saddle up and enjoy your Saturday, folks. All right, speaking of Saturday, we've got Florida State looking to go on the road and grab what would be a quad one victory over NC State. If this were being played in Tallahassee, it would not be a quad one win, but because it's on the road, it is. KenPom has Florida State only favored by 73-72, and we just saw what NC State did to a good, although perhaps slightly softer than normal version of a Duke team. What are you expecting, Michael?
You know, this is a matchup that I have not been looking forward to all year. When they interviewed the coach for Keats for NC State, he said that Florida State plays the way that they want to be playing, and I think that his lineup has a pretty strong ability to give FSU some problems. You know, they have. Not even counting C.J. Bryce, who's their lead scorer. He's a guy who I think that we can actually contain if we focus on him. Markel Johnson is their second leading scorer, and then Devin Daniels is their third or fourth scorer. And Daniels and Markel Johnson just make a living getting inside the defense and, you know, making good things happen. We have no one on the roster who can stop Markel Johnson one-on-one. Devin Daniels is a little bigger, not quite as quick. So, you know, we can contain him. The good news is that they're not a very good shooting team. So typically, yeah, tell that to Duke, right? They're not a particularly good shooting team. So when they do get inside the defense, the damage is most likely to be done, you know, at the rim as opposed to driving in and kicking out for threes. If they are kicking out for threes, I think that's probably in our favor just because they don't have a guy on their team who is, you know, a 40-plus percent shooter from three, not a single one. I think the highest on the team is like 36%. So they have a lot of okay shooters, nobody great. I'm really seriously concerned about you know, Johnson and Devin Daniels.
Well, and Markell, first of all, I think Markell, he came in that Ingen Etzer class, right? I feel like he was maybe in Herb's last, or maybe Sydney's first class. I don't know. No, it feels like he's been there forever. But he kind of has that XRM look to me, where he almost seems like a better shooter off the bounce, where he's sort of forced to get his feet up underneath him, square his shoulders, and really get good lift on his jumper, as opposed to perhaps some of the catch and shoot situations. I don't have a maybe we can do a Kickstarter to get a subscription to Synergy. So but at this point, I haven't been able to verify that on Synergy, but it just appears to me that he is a more comfortable shooter off the bounce. But let me throw a couple numbers at you, and you tell me if we're going to play a game here where I say a number that either looks like it could be in our favor or could be a concern. You tell me if you think we'll be able to actually, if that will come to fruition, or if we could maybe turn the tide. So first one here is that NC State only turns it over 16.8% of their possessions, which is 43rd in the country, 43rd out of 353. So we like to turn teams over. That's how we thrive to get into our offense. Does that concern you that they only turn it over, less than 17% of the time?
Yeah, I think what we've seen out of our defense is that when we're not turning teams over, we're not particularly special in any way on defense. So we really have to be disruptive, for our defense to be firing on all cylinders. And so if NC State is able to take care of the ball and eke out good possessions, then this is going to be a tough game for Florida State to be able to score enough, to be able to keep up with them, especially since we're on the road.
All right. I agree. I think that it will be tough. I will say, though, I think we will – I don't know if we're going to turn them over 25% of the time like we have to some teams, but I would bet that we turn them over higher than average. The question is, will those be live ball, and can we turn them into dunks and layups? So let's go to another number. This one may be in Florida State's favor. NC State gives up almost 30% of offensive boards. So on when they're on defense, they give up on the 30% of the time almost of offensive rebound, which is 258th in the country. Will Florida State, maybe perhaps will Patrick Williams, be able to take advantage there?
Yeah, so Florida State is 3-5 in games in which they get fewer than 30% of their own misses. And they're, 19-1 or something in games when they get at least 30% of their
really?
Misses.
Really? That's a great – 19-1 when we grab at least 30% of our own misses?
Yeah, see what you learn when you call me in to this little thing.
You know what? This is why we pay you the big bucks, sir.
Right. The one game we lost where we actually rebounded pretty well was Duke, and, that was a good game.
We shot horribly, yeah.
It's exactly. So – I really like the fact that NC State is not a great rebounding team. Their bigs are not, sort of space clearing bigs that, for say someone like Vernon Carey, they're more like pogo stick bigs. And so you can get some rebounds around their big guys, even though Florida State will most likely be playing small most of the game.
I hope so. I'll admit and say that DJ Funderburk scares me, and I don't know that he does any one particular thing like that well. He doesn't really rebound. Actually, his defensive rebounding numbers are very similar to Bolsa, although he plays a lot more minutes than Bolsa. He's an okay shooter from like a 16 footer type stuff. He doesn't really have 3-point range. He's only made 4 in the season, but when I watch NC State, and I've seen them play a couple times, he does scare me, and we're going to need to make sure we get a body on him. But overall, great stat with the 19-1, and overall, I do think that we've started to see some progress be made there from guys like Pat and Bolsa, that they're really starting to just come into their own on the offensive glass, and it's making a difference. All right, here's one more for you, and this one is the number 7. So that NC State only go 7 deep right now. They've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 guys who are playing at, who have played at least 40% of their minutes, and nobody else is really getting any run at all. And then when you combine that with the fact that they are a decently fast-paced team, they're not, you know, the Tar Heels, but they're the third fastest tempo in the conference, and Florida State also doesn't mind running a bit. Do you see, is that something where if the game's close around maybe the 10-minute mark, is that advantage FSU?
It is, but probably not as much as people are hoping for. You know, if you look at the guys that Keats has been recruiting, these dudes are, they're ripped and they're in shape. They're used to running up and down the court for 38 minutes a game or something. Markell Johnson, you can't tell me that guy has ever once been tired in a basketball game. And a few of the other players are just kind of the same way. You know, they're not these, it's not Notre Dame. You know, Notre Dame, we could wear down by making them run. NC State's going to be a little tougher. You know, of course, nobody, you know, outside of Markell Johnson, I guess, can consistently play that high of minutes without having some sort of drop off. And so, you know, this is a game where you had mentioned live ball turnovers earlier. You know, this is a game where we are going to have to figure out a way to ramp up the tempo, you know, sort of on both ends of the floor. I don't know that we're going to go zone, you know, a whole bunch to try to slow them down or anything. I think this is a game where we want everybody running all the time, so that there is actually a chance to kind of wear them down in the second half. If we play a slow paced game, they could all play 40 minutes and probably be fine.
Yeah. Look at the numbers on Markell Johnson, here. We'll just maybe do the last eight or 10 games, but so 38 minutes against Virginia on January 20th, 38 minutes against Georgia Tech on the 25th, 36 against UNC 2 days later after that Georgia Tech game, 35 against Louisville, 36 against Miami, 32 against Syracuse. He actually only played 18 against Boston College in a loss last week because he had four fouls and really sat much of the game with foul trouble, but then 36 against Duke. So essentially every game other than that BC game, he's playing 35 plus minutes. He's put a couple 39s on the board earlier this year. But like you said, he just never seems to get tired. I don't know. I'd like to think that maybe this is the game where even if he still physically is fine, that we, you know, going back to our conversation about Trent, does that lead to some mental miscues? And while he certainly is, he's one of the ACC's leaders in assists, he's also got a fairly high turnover rate. He's been over 20% for a turnover rate his entire career. I think is assuming Devin Vassell plays, assuming MJ Walker plays and Pat Williams, I do think we can force him into some maybe unfocused errors and perhaps get some 4 or 6 point bursts on the board with some transition dunks. All right.
Yeah, that's a good call. And you know, Markell Johnson probably grew up in a house with a VHS tape because he's got a lot of Allen Iverson in his game, and which is not good if you're not Allen Iverson.
Yeah.
So Florida State can definitely kind of bait him into taking a few bad shots and making some silly passes and that sort of thing. It's just, and you know, hopefully, like you said, if he gets a little bit mentally worn down, you know, he'll be more likely to do those things.
Yeah, in their win. So last night he had one turnover against Duke earlier in the year when they beat beat Miami, Clemson, and Virginia in back-to-back-to-back games in January. They were playing pretty well. He had in those three games a combined three turnovers, right? And you know, that Virginia is not necessarily a team that's going to wear you out and go up and down. They're not at all, actually. But so he, in their wins, he has controlled those turnovers. In their losses, so even though he only played 18 minutes against BC, he had six turnovers. He had four against UNC, four against Georgia Tech, six against Clemson when they lost to Clemson, five against Virginia Tech. So I think, you know, Markell is a guy that could be the fulcrum point of the game right there. Are we able to get bad Markell or let's say inconsistent Markell out there where he's taking wild shots, turning the ball over, or is it the Markell that just showed up against Duke that went 5 for 6 from three, was able to get to pick his spots in the court, set up others, and finish with 9 rebounds and 4 assists with just the 1 turnover. So he is certainly the guy that needs to be, you know, honed in on by the Florida State defense. Let's maybe do some predictions. I know you said you haven't been feeling this matchup. NC State may be slightly less desperate than they were perhaps at the beginning of the week, although their NCAA tournament resume is nowhere near safe. They would probably be on the wrong side of the bubble if the tournament committee chose things today. What is your prediction going into this game?
Yeah, I think I have, let's see here, 9, 10, 11 consecutive games in which I've picked Florida State to win. The last time I picked them to lose was against Louisville on the road. So take this to, you know, you can use that to kind of bolster your hopes about this game. But I think Florida State's going to drop this one. I think that it has nothing to do with how NC State bounces back from Duke. I think it's just a bad matchup for Florida State. If this is one of those games where, you know, if we're in the, say, 4-5 game or 3-6 game in the NCAA tournament, and I saw this matchup coming, I would be pretty upset about the draw. You know, we talk a lot about how important the draw is, and I think that, you know, this is a team that just, it's just not a good, you know, it's not a good draw for FSU. And so I think we're going to lose, you know, probably be a close game. I'll take NC State, like, you know, 74-69 or something along those lines.
I can't say I blame you for any of that logic. I get it. I do. So it's a tough arena to play in. It's almost like an NCAA tournament arena. It's big. Sight lines aren't necessarily the best. It's kind of a cavernous arena. It's also where they play hockey, the Carolina Hurricanes. So, you know, the court isn't always, you know, ideal. But I don't know. I actually think that Florida State's been playing pretty well lately. We've talked before about, like, teams go through just like, so basketball is a game of runs, and the individual games themselves are games of runs where, you know, just, we were talking, NC State's up 20, Duke cuts it to 10, and then NC State goes back up 20. And the season is sort of a game of runs as well. And we just, like Louisville, for instance, they had their kind of, they were in a rut last week. And last week would have been a great week to play Louisville. They seem to have bounced back out of that. Florida State seemed to be in a bit of a rut when they, earlier in the year, really didn't play all that well at Miami, squeaked out a win despite, again, not playing well against Notre Dame, and then lost to Virginia on the road. I think we've been playing better. I know that we lost the Duke game. I think we even said that night, for shooting as poorly as we did, it's pretty incredible. We were only, we were in it at the end. I thought we played pretty well overall. The Syracuse game, look, I know it was a 3-point game, and I know what Louisville just did to Syracuse. We played that game without our leading scorer and rebounder and had MJ Walker out for most of the game, and still led by double digits in the second half. And then the Pittsburgh game was just, and Pittsburgh's not great, but that second half was completely blowing them out the door. And so I think that it's going to be a battle. There's going to be times where it looks like NC State is maybe going to pull away. But some way, somehow, this mentally tough team finds a way to get it done. I'll say put me down for a little bit higher scoring than maybe what the computer suggests, and I'll say 79-77 Florida State, within a massive matchup against Louisville 2 days later. All right. I think that's going to do it. We'll be back probably Sunday to wrap up the NC State game and preview the Louisville game. For Michael, I'm Matt. Maybe Michael's cough will be better by then too, but otherwise, go Noles.